like a failure. She was frustrated with herself for not speaking up more, and worried that her poor performance, and her ready accessions to her father, would jeopardize her future. Her mother was leasing a manor house in Lochhaven called Castlebury, and they were brought there by Zephyr immediately following the meeting. Because her parents were estranged, the Privy Council subsidized the rent on the Castlebury Manor out of the allowance the Prince Regent was given. Mother had her own inheritance as well, which Mr. Durant had managed to apportion, and so when Sarah arrived, she found a beautifully appointed residence. It was on a street with 13 other homes, which shared a common landing area. As Sarah walked into the manor and observed the servants busily at work, she felt herself a stranger and longed for the simple dormitory at Vicar's Close. Mr. Durant was pacing the foyer energetically as he awaited their arrival. The moment she entered, he walked up to her with a worried look. But she gazed around him and saw Hugild waiting with the keeper of the house. Sarah practically squealed and rushed past Mr. Durant. Her former governess had aged quite a bit over the last 4 years. She had more wrinkles and was gaunter than before.
"Hugild! Sweet Hugild!"
Sarah gushed, hugging her and kissing her. Her cheeks smelled of peppermint.
"There's my little Sarah," Hugild said with tears in her voice. "My, how you've grown."
"I've not grown at all,"
Sarah said, pulling back and wiping her eyes with the back of her hand.
"But you have. Yes, you have. What a beautiful young woman you've become."
Sarah was conscious that her mother was watching them, but she could not restrain her effusiveness. Hugild had been more of a mother to Sarah than anyone else. She had put up with Sarah's tantrums and stubbornness, always, and while her governess had become exasperated with her at times, there had never been any doubt as to her feelings.
"I want to speak with you, to hear about where you've been, what you've been doing. Can you wait for me in my rooms, Hugild?"
"Of course, Miss Fitzempress,"
the older woman replied lovingly.
"Yes," Mr. Durant interrupted. "You can save the gushing for later. Sarah, we need to talk. And not in the hall in front of the servants. Madam, may we retire to your library?"
"Of course, Mr. Durant," said Sarah's mother.
Sarah gave Mr. Durant an arch look.
"I haven't seen her in 4 years, Mr. Durant." She squeezed Hugild's hands and kissed them. "I need not make excuses to you."
"Yes, Sarah, nor do I wish to hear them. I am relieved to see you are well. The rumors coming from the Abbey are truly disturbing. If we may retire..."
He gestured her toward a hallway door.
"I will come presently," Sarah promised, giving Hugild another hug.
Then she followed her mother and Mr. Durant into the study. A tray of fruit had been arrayed on a nearby table, and Sarah suddenly realized she was famished. The melons were cubed, and she bypassed the little silver pinchers and began plucking fruit from the tray.
"Where are your manners, Seraphine?"
Mother scolded.
"It's all right, madam. We are in private company," Mr. Durant said. "When word came of the attack at Mirwood, I feared the worst and cursed myself for not insisting more strongly that you leave with me. If I had realized the extent of the danger, I would have forcibly removed you."
Sarah was touched by the look of alarm and worry on his face. Or perhaps he was merely reacting to the fact that his fortunes were tied to her success. He had made enemies supporting her cause.
"As you can see, I am uninjured," Sarah answered. "I'm more worried about the Aldermaston. He's gravely hurt, and his pilot was shot and killed."
"His pilot?"
Mr. Durant asked with astonishment.
"But he's a Mastin. How could that be?"
"No one knows. Lord Fitzroy is investigating the matter. The Ministry of War has sent in people as well. It is still too early to be certain of anything."
Mr. Durant still looked agitated.
"And you went straight to the Privy Council upon your arrival? How did that fare?"
"I would like to know that as well," said her mother, who hadn't been allowed in that meeting. "Your father looked smug afterward."
Mr. Durant turned to Sarah with a concerned look.
"That does not bode well."
"Indeed. And it didn't go well," Sarah said, feeling anxiety spread in her chest like a disease. "I was too subdued. The news caught us all by surprise. I was so stunned I didn't know what to say." Father came across as decisive and concerned.
Did he seem surprised by the news? This might have been set up by the Ministry of War.
I don't think so, but I cannot be certain. By the end of the council meeting, they dismissed me and said they would summon me tomorrow for an interview. I was almost an afterthought.
You should have spoken up, her mother said worriedly.
Please, madam,
Mr. Durant intervened, holding up his hand.
I think Sarah is fully conscious of any mistakes she may have made. It does no good to litigate evidence in a case already determined. Of course, your father handled the surprise better. He may or may not have been previously informed, and he has certainly gained experience in the role of leadership over the last 4 years. The timing of the events is entirely too suspicious, however.
I agree, Sarah said. The man who attacked came around the same time as the ship from the Ministry of War. And if they are conducting the investigation on the attack and are the ones behind it, then we won't see an honest result. Mr. Durant pressed his fingers together as he paced. He was deep in thought.
There are multiple strategies at play here, Sarah. It is critical to unravel them quickly. First, your grandfather died, likely of natural causes, and his death has set in motion irrevocable events. A new emperor must be chosen. Because your grandfather did not, nay, could not, name an heir, it is up to the Privy Council to decide. Of the possible Fitz-Empress heirs, you and your father are unequivocally the most suitable due to your uncle's mismanagement of their funds. One of them could be behind this, trying to discredit the both of you and claim the rewards that will come with the office. Their creditors surely would wish this. Second, we soon receive a delegation from the court of King Fountain. A match between our two worlds would be unpopular, but it may improve our relations with that world and put an end to the hostilities between our peoples. There are undoubtedly some factions in King Fountain that would not want this to come to pass. They may also be behind it.
Do not forget my husband's ambition, Mother said flatly, her eyes like daggers. He covets the throne. He feels entitled to it, I assure you of that, Mr. Durant.
His ambition is naked for all to see,
Mr. Durant scoffed.
And the Privy Council knows it, which is what gives Sarah the advantage in this case. There is a reason that the rights of inheritance no longer pass directly from the father to the eldest child. Sometimes they are the least qualified to assume the burdens of state. Your father's brothers stand testament to the wisdom of this policy. History is replete with examples of the misery that can follow the rule of an evil man or woman. Power does corrupt, that much is blatant. No, Sarah, do not fret over your performance today. You will not be judged by a single incident. The Privy Council is wise on the whole. They want to choose someone who will protect and preserve the Empire.
But does that mean, Mr. Durant, Sarah asked, that they would also want to preserve the social hierarchy? You know I intend to make certain changes.
Of course,
Mr. Durant beamed.
And I have ever been your most ardent admirer. These past years I have done my part to curry favor with Lord Wells. I've already told you how influential you may be to his success. I've also done whatever I can to inform the people of your intended policies. Believe me, you are well-liked down in the city. And there is great suffering. The cholera morbus is a terrible blight. No one is safe from it. Why, just last week it struck another manor here in Lockhaven. The entire household was banished to the city, and those who took them there have been refused permission to return until they can prove they are not suffering from the contagion. Your father has had no success in solving this epidemic.
Surely it's not his fault, Sarah objected. Mr. Durant shrugged.
The people don't care whose fault it is. He is a ruler, and so he is blamed.
And so would I be, Sarah said with exasperation, were I in charge. It's irrational, Mr. Durant.
People are irrational,
he countered.
They make decisions every day that are against their own self-interest, and let's not forget the people of King Fountain and their water rights. How quick they are to consider us a threat to their way of life. We cannot change that aspect of humanity. But I believe, and I know that you do too, that if we spend some energy alleviating the suffering of the poor here, if we can forge a season of peace with our enemies, then you will go down in history as one of the most benevolent monarchs of all time. The laws of the Empire favor the wealthy minority. They were established to ensure the hierarchy.
It was established with good cause, Mother said in a warning tone.
You toy with it, Mr. Durant, at the peril of us all. Change must be made wisely or not at all.
Sarah clasped her hands and tapped her lips with her joined forefingers. I have studied history in Mirwood, Mother, she said, giving her a sharp look. You speak of the revolts, the rebellions, the wars with other worlds. Her mother nodded firmly.
King Fountain wants to rule us and liberate our people from our authority. And our own poor would probably celebrate the savages. They are both different than us.
Sarah shook her head no emphatically.
They are no different than us, Mother. Consider how our own decisions have brought this upon us. How badly we have dishonored Empress Maya's vision. She wished to give all of her people the opportunity to study and learn the mysteries. The schools were founded for that very reason. But in the end, we took that right away from them. They built her seat of power in the sky to keep it safe from invaders. We've imitated that with Lockhaven to separate ourselves from our own poor.
Well said, Miss Fitzempress.
Mr. Durant clasped his hands behind his back.
A speech like that in the Privy Council tomorrow will find favor with many, I assure you. There will be some who will be offended by it, but it will make an impression. Each ministry has struggled with the others for supremacy. When business flourishes, the Ministry of Law blooms. When there is an invention, the Ministry of Wind excels. But the interplay between the two always leads to conflict, to disruption. And then the Ministry of War takes power. And after war, the Ministry of Thought comes to achieve the promise of peace. It's like the four seasons, only they do not rotate every year. These seasons can last for years, decades even. It is past time for a season of change, a time to break the molds, a time to end the corruption. Only the younger generation can achieve this.
Here he gave her a cunning look.
Because they alone cannot see something difficult as impossible. They've not been jaded by the failures of the past.
He gave a sidelong look to her mother.
Do not let anyone force you to marry, Sarah. You must be different. You must seize what opportunities you can. The rules do not apply to you. You are the maker of them.
Sarah felt a part of her buzzing inside. Mr. Durant's words had reawakened her self-confidence, her courage to defy the odds and claim her birthright.
You swell her head with all your pretty talk, Mr. Durant, Mother said warily.
I trust her enough to take that risk, he replied evenly.
When she finally went to her rooms after the long conversation with her mother and Mr. Durant, Sarah felt like resting. But she was too eager to see Hugild, whom she found doing needlework on the small sofa. In an instant, it felt like she had shed years and was once again a little girl seeking wisdom from her governess. Hugild looked up from her work.
There you are. Quiet as a mouse. I almost didn't hear the door open.
Are you tired, Hugild? Do you need to rest?
What? Is Sarah concerned about an older woman's aches and pains? You have changed.
Sarah shrugged. I'm not as selfish as I used to be. It's so good to see you, Hugild. How I've missed you. You went back to Hotland, didn't you?
Yes, to my own people, she answered, setting the needlework aside.
She rose and came to Sarah and took her hands.
It was not easy finding work after your father dismissed me. He forbade me to contact you. His advocate sent for me, saying that I might be able to regain approval in the eyes of the Prince Regent if I came to serve you again.
She lowered her lashes.
In another realm.
Sarah felt a sickly feeling in her stomach.
Another realm?
Hugild shuddered.
I have been living very humbly, Sarah. Last winter I feared I might die of cold.
She looked into Sarah's eyes.
Your father's advocate offered to pay me a sizable sum if I would persuade you to seek the prince's affections. He seeks to use me to manipulate you. I agreed to come, agreed to do his wishes, but only so I could warn you
Your father seeks your downfall. That man is determined to ruin you.
Chapter 15 Ministry Secrets. Lord Prentice, the Prime Minister, met Sarah outside the Privy Council chamber the following day. A large block-shaped man with an expressive face and prominent forehead, he had light brown hair that had receded far back on his scalp, but still grew long at his ears and the nape of his neck. He had a cunning look that immediately put Sarah on her guard. She had come early and worn her violet and silver frock. Hugild had braided her hair in a regal style and had applied some subtle embellishment to her lips and cheeks, which made her look older than 16.
"You are early, Miss Fitzempress,"
Lord Prentice said.
"I was told you'd just arrived."
"Early is on time," Sarah answered with a nod. "I'm ready to see the council."
"Not all the members have assembled yet," he answered. "Would you walk with me around the corridor for a turn? There is something I would like to show you before the meeting starts."
"Oh? And what would that be?"
"Something you will be intrigued to see, my dear. You have been at Mirwood for nearly 4 years, so you have learned that each estate contains a room that controls all of the Learings throughout the place. I would like to show you this one."
He was right. Sarah was intrigued. But there was a reason he had offered to do this. This man had been selected by her father over Lord Fitzroy, which had opened the position of Minister of Wind to Seti's guardian. Sarah was certain that Prentice supported her father, so why would he attempt to do her a favor? She would have to be on her guard, but she wanted to see what he was about. "Thank you, Lord Prentice. Shall we see it now, then?"
"Of course. Follow me."
He escorted her down the corridor and around the bend. It would be easy to conceal a door since there were so many throughout the palace, each with a little bronze plaque with a number etched onto it. He brought her to the one marked 117. "Curious that there is no one guarding it," Sarah said as he fished in his vest pocket for the key. He gave her a knowing smile.
"The guardians are behind the door,"
he said.
"Otherwise it would be too obvious that this room is important. Ah, here we are."
He produced the key, which was an iron key of ancient make, the metal mottled with rust stains. Rather than insert it in the lock, he merely held it near the handle. She felt a throb, and then the door opened of its own accord. As she entered, she saw two men in uniform, their rank symbols showing one to be a lieutenant and the other to be a captain.
"Prime Minister?"
both men said in unison, bowing stiffly.
"Good afternoon, gentlemen,"
he answered, slipping the key back into his pocket. There were no couches or other furniture in the room, just the two men and a very large mirror at the end of a short pathway. She sensed a leering embedded into the frame. It probed her thoughts, giving her feelings of disquiet for a moment, but the anxiety was quickly followed by a sense of calm.
"This way, Miss Fitzempress,"
he said, gesturing to the mirror. As Sarah approached it with curiosity, she felt a strangeness about the room. It was akin to the feelings she had when passing the abbey itself at Mirwood. There were definitely leerings here, one she could not see beyond the mirror. The Prime Minister waved his hand in front of the mirror. Again she felt a pulse against her mind. The glass of the mirror shimmered and disappeared, exposing a corridor lit by leerings. He stepped inside the frame, and Sarah followed. There was no dust in the corridor. Her shoes tapped against the stone tiles and echoed down the hall. As she walked, she felt the mirror reform behind them. Her heart leaped with the sensation, and she looked back and saw that the mirror exposed the two soldiers in the room. But she had a feeling that they could no longer see her.
"It is a solemn privilege to guard this room,"
Prentice told her in a low voice.
"There must always be two guardians. No man is ever left alone. They rotate the watch every few hours and assign new soldiers to the duty routinely to keep anyone from becoming too familiar. It is a strict precaution."
"Against what?" Sarah asked.
The echo of her voice sounded strange in her ears.
You will see.
When they reached the end of the hall, there was a stone door blocking the way. A man's scarred face was carved into the door, the eyes blank, the hair pointed like quills. It was a fearsome countenance.
This leering was carved in the likeness of the First Empress's bodyguard,
Prentice said. She felt the pulse of a command emanate from him, and then the stone door slid open. Behind the door was an atrium. A brilliant glow emanated from the ceiling. At first, Sarah thought it was open to the sunlight, but then she realized that the rectangular opening was lit by a powerful light leering that only resembled daylight. Stone pillars surrounded a shallow pool of still water, and a couch sat near two of the pillars. The water was clean and translucent, and she could see the black and white marble tiles that lay beneath it. Across from the couch stood a round pillar about waist height, supporting a leering carved in the likeness of a familiar woman. Her expression was peaceful, her eyes slightly downcast.
Empress Maya,
whispered the Prime Minister in a reverent tone. Colorful tapestries decorated the walls, full of images celebrating the past, but the focal point of the room was undeniably the pillar with the leering on it. Sarah felt a strange tugging sensation at her heart. The Prime Minister walked around the circuit of the room and then paused by the pedestal.
You understand, no doubt, the importance of keys and what they symbolize?
Sarah knew the answer well enough. They are symbols of trust and the delegation of authority.
Precisely, Your Highness.
There was something odd in his voice. She was still on her guard. It was just the two of them, and she felt a twinge of vulnerability. Perhaps it had not been wise to follow him here.
Power is derived from the mysteries. You will understand this better after you have taken the Abbey's test. But some power is hereditary. Some is earned. Yours, for example, is the hereditary kind. You have the right to rule because of the lineage of your ancestors. I do not. My power as Prime Minister comes from delegation of authority. Once I am removed from office, my key will be given to another, and I will never be allowed to enter this room again. I will not miss it, for it is a heavy responsibility. A burden, truly. Those who serve grow weary in the service.
He didn't sound weary at all. What does this one do? She asked, nodding toward the leering with the Empress's face. All leerings do something.
Empress Maya had a special gift. It was called the Gift of Invocation. She had a special affinity toward leerings. To her, each one had its own chord. They were almost like music.
He gave her a piercing look.
Do you hear the music that fills this room, Seraphine?
He gazed up at the illusion of the skylight. Sarah felt the power of the mysteries in the room, but it did not strike her as music. It struck her on a more visceral level, one that made her slightly afraid, like one would feel in the presence of a lion or another savage animal. She wasn't about to answer his question. Why did you bring me here, Prime Minister? He gave her a shrewd look.
Empress Maya was warned by her grandmother, a harbinger, that a foreign power would attempt to invade her empire by sea. She built Lockhaven to master the air, but being so high above the city, she feared losing touch with the common people and their needs. She maintained a spy network, of course, as most rulers do. But she did not wish to rely on their reports alone. The lifeblood of any civilization is its water. People need to drink, to bathe, to grow food, to wash. Water is paramount. Within the city below, there are dozens of fountains that provide fresh drinking water through leerings. The people are ignorant of how this water comes to them, of course, but the fountains were a gift from the Empress. The people had their water, and the Empress could watch over them from this room. Here, put your hand on the stone and I will show you. You will see what your father has often seen.
Are you brave enough to face it?
So it was a test of her courage, was it? What grisly scene might unfold before her? What horrors did he intend to show her? Thank you, Lord Prentice. I would be glad to see my subjects. She steeled her resolve, stepped forward, and put her hand on the stone. At first, she felt nothing but the smooth texture of the rock on her skin. The air smelled damp. Then the Prime Minister joined his hand to the leering and invoked it. She felt the power surge inside of her, and then the waters of the pool began to ripple. As she watched in fascination, the ripples calmed and the pool no longer reflected the light beating down on it from above. It showed her a scene from one of the many fountain squares in the city below. People had gathered around the fountain, washerwomen scrubbing laundry, some carrying pitchers to tote water back to their homes. The square down below was grimy and noisy. She could hear the nicker of horses and the clatter of wagon wheels on cobblestones. She heard arguing and some women shouting at each other in anger. All her senses fired. In addition to seeing the scene, she could hear it and smell it as surely as if she were standing in their midst.
This is happening right now,
Lord Prentice said.
See how they scold and yell at one another? Do you see the urchin, that little girl reaching her grubby hand into the filthy water to steal a drink? See the washerwomen? Listen to them reproach her.
Sarah heard it even as it happened.
Even though they've dirtied the water, they still prize it.
Sarah's heart panged as she watched one of the washerwomen seize the little girl and cuff her on the ear and yell at her to go away.
Sometimes, like during the Whitsunday festival, he continued, people climb into the fountains and dance in them with their muddied shoes. They profane that which gives them life. But of course people will profane anything when they are drunk and the people in the tenements drink constantly. They do it because they suffer, and they believe inebriation will quiet the ache in their hearts. But that ache is caused by the debauchery of their lives. You may as well prick a finger with a sharp needle and beg it not to bleed. They cannot see the true cause of their suffering. No, they blame it on us. And those in King Fountain consider these abominations an utter sacrilege.
That's not true, Sarah answered, her feelings becoming more and more riled as she watched the village square. She spoke her words vehemently. They are oppressed, and we are their oppressors.
I agree with you, he answered, which startled her. But not in the way you are thinking. We oppress them because we show them there is a higher way to live. They want what we have, but they don't want to get it the way we have gotten it. They'd like it to be given to them.
Some do, Sarah countered, thinking of Seti.
Of course,
he said placatingly. She could hear the condescension in his voice.
There will always be exceptions, like your friend. But let me tell you the truth of things, Seraphine Fitz-Empress. It is a truth that even Empress Maya, who once shared your idealism, came to realize. Only a small portion of the people will ever reach their true potential in life, because it is difficult. Because one must pursue excellence with unwearying vigilance, and that, my young friend, is beyond the capacity of most of humanity. People like to believe that success is merely the product of hard work, but it isn't. The secrets of the mysteries aren't yielded to hard work alone. We are all tested by the knowing every single day. These people living in squalor are tested. Will they put another's interest above their own? Will they speak kindly instead of screaming? Will they let themselves be cheated without growing resentful? Do you see them, Miss Sarah? Are they even capable of it?
Sarah's anger was blazing now. She stared at him across the pool.
Are they given the chance?
Of course, he replied with scorn. The Ministry of Thought is constantly teaching those principles, yet, sadly, The teachings are almost universally ignored when it comes to the drudgery of daily life. They sit in a stupor on their holy days, anxious for the meetings to end so they can get back to work and earn a few pence. The men beat their wives, and the wives scold their husbands. They both torture their offspring in ways that would disgust you, were I to share even a portion of what I've seen.
Seti had begun life as an urchin, a poor and helpless soul mired in the drudgery of daily life in the fells, and she had become spectacular. No one at the Abbey had more talent than she. Then there were plenty of other cases of the rich and powerful, of the Mastons, squandering the gifts they'd been given. Stephen wished only to enjoy his wealth and prestige. Her father, the Prince Regent, wanted only power. And there was a very good chance someone in the highest echelons of the government had arranged for the attack at Muirwood. No. The Prime Minister was simplifying things. He wished for an easy answer, and so he'd found one that assuaged his guilt. "You are wrong, Prime Minister," she said, her voice trembling with emotion.
"Am I? Have I not risen to the pinnacle of power because I have harnessed the power of thought? I tell you, Miss Sarah, that thoughts can be as contagious as diseases, like the cholera morbus. You wish to build a bridge down to the city to enlighten them, a noble cause, to be sure. But most of the drudges who live down below lack all self-control. You, my dear, would bring the diseased to us to infect us with their spores. And by doing so, you would cause Lockhaven to come crashing down into the planet's tender crust."
The image shifted to another. This one was a windswept prairie full of boulders. No, the crumbled ruins of a fallen manor. The grassy valley was in the midst of a crater the size of a lake, and Sarah gasped when she saw the devastation. If a single manor had caused so much damage, what would Lockhaven do if it ever fell?
"You are gazing from the eyes of a leering set by the Ministry of Wind to study the healing process of the land,"
he explained dispassionately.
"It took years before plants would start to grow again in that pit. The blow was so deep that jets of noxious gases were expelled from the slits and seams in the earth. It is quite a fascinating study."
"Why are you showing me this?" Sarah challenged, gazing back from the wreckage to his cunning eyes. "Do you hope to change my mind? To persuade me to abandon the very hope that drives someone to succeed? That would be hypocritical of you, Prime Minister." He removed his hand from the leering and stepped around the pool. He didn't alter his tone or try to sway her.
"No, Seraphine. Because I wanted it to be very clear in your mind why I will oppose you."
Chapter 16. Shifting Loyalties. If Lord Prentice had intended to rattle Sarah with his declaration before the meeting, he had only succeeded in making her more determined to overthrow him. She was beleaguered by the Privy Council's questions, but she had done her best to project confidence and self-assurance. That her goals would, in the long term, benefit soldiers and statesmen, bankers and borrowers alike. They had wandered off the path Empress Maya had set out for them, but it was not too late to return to it. No doubt her mother and Mr. Durant would be eager for her to recount the meeting, but she needed some quiet, some time to think. At least she would have a few moments to herself on the Zephyr back to Castlebury. She didn't notice that she had attracted an entourage of a dozen soldiers from the Ministry of War until she boarded the Zephyr. When her Zephyr rose into the air, four other Zephyrs and a Tempest, which loomed overhead, immediately surrounded it. She craned her neck, seeing the military insignia on the great ship's hull.
"We're getting an escort from now on, my lady,"
the captain shouted down to her above the thrum of the wind.
"Compliments of the Minister of War."
The shadow of the Tempest skyship reminded her that her life was in very real danger. That there might be a faction inside their own government, or perhaps an external enemy, that did not want her to ascend to the throne.
She had always wanted to experience something truly exciting, however, and couldn't deny that the risk brought a certain element of thrill. When they arrived at the landing pad, the pilot's declaration from earlier was confirmed. A squad awaited her arrival on the street. Each soldier had an arquebus strapped to their shoulder, and they stood at fixed attention as her skyship landed. The feeling of excitement intensified as she wondered if Will might be one of them. He had said he would soon be in Lockhaven. She leaned over the rail and examined their faces, but they were a good distance away, and each was wearing a hat as part of their uniform. She descended the gangplank into the yard, and the two columns of soldiers snapped to attention and hoisted their weapons. Strolling confidently ahead as if this kind of reception were ordinary for her, Sarah clasped her hands before her and discreetly examined each soldier's face. Some were young, but most were seasoned and experienced. Will was not among them. It would seem her speech had at least impressed Lord Wells. When she reached the doorway, it was opened by her mother's butler, who greeted her and directed her to the study. Mr. Durant, her mother, and Hugild awaited her with cups of tea. Mr. Durant sized her up.
"Well, she still looks regal. They did not flatten her like a pan of potato hash, at least."
"Welcome back, daughter,"
her mother said primly, but her eyes were eager for news. "There are guards in front of the house," Sarah said. "And we were given an escort from court."
"Yes,"
Mr. Durant said flippantly.
"I had to prove my credentials before they would let me into the house. It's a necessary inconvenience. Lord Wells must prove he is taking his duty seriously. A captain is quartered inside and is interrogating the servants to ensure none of them poses a danger. This is serious business, Sarah. But back to the matters at hand. How did the Privy Council go?"
"I have a pounding headache, if that's any indication," Sarah answered. She saw a pitcher of water and poured herself a glass. Her throat was parched, and the water tasted delicious. Then she remembered the display from earlier that day. She remembered the little girl getting slapped.
"Council meetings can be arduous,"
he said, raising his eyebrows questioningly. Sarah set down the glass and turned to face them, more determined than ever. "It went as well as could be expected. Before the meeting started, Lord Prentice took me to the secret room that controls the leerings of the court. He made it very clear to me that he opposed my ascension. In the council meeting, he kept harping on my youth and extreme inexperience. He made it clear that if the council chose me, he would demand there be a regency so that I could learn, more slowly, how to take on the reins of government." Durant started to massage his own temples, as if her headache had proved contagious.
"Well, that was bold of him. What game is he playing, revealing the valuable Dominion cards in his hand so quickly? I thought Prentice was more clever than that. He must be overconfident that he can win the set."
"He lectured me," Sarah went on, trying to bridle her temper and failing, "on my interest in helping the downtrodden. He all but confirmed that they are deliberately suppressed to prevent their lower thoughts and ways from infecting our way of life. He warned that mixing with them would cause calamities that could rupture the earth. No one could ever accuse the Prime Minister of being too understated." Her mother's expression indicated she agreed with the Prime Minister's outlook, something Sarah had long suspected. It was the one thing her parents agreed upon.
"But surely, Seraphine, it would be wise to proceed with caution."
"Please, Mother," Sarah said, cutting her off. "I'm not in the mood for a lecture. Consider the adage we're all taught in school. Isn't it true that we reap what we sow? Lord Prentice gave me a glimpse of the misery and suffering down in the city, and what I saw only confirms what Seti has told me the last 4 years. Our problems impact their lives just as theirs impact ours. How many have died from the cholera morbus within Lockhaven itself? It takes effort and labor to maintain a garden, even more so to maintain an empire. But we've let the garden run wild for years. Building a higher wall won't keep us safe, nor will it solve anything." I tried to explain this to the Privy Council. "I know it will take time. Yes, the work will be arduous and difficult, but I am determined to see it done." Her mother looked as angry and out of sorts as the Prime Minister had an hour ago. Mr. Durant, on the other hand, looked pleased by her little speech.
Well said, Sarah. A bit idealistic and simplistic, but the argument is sturdy. I'm sure you studied the faces in the room. It's not important that you delivered a decent speech or upheld your high principles. Were you convincing? How many looked at you skeptically? Do you know their names? How can we, through careful coaxing, win more to your side? This is the art of politics, my dear. They all have concerns about having a young woman rule over them, and some of their concerns are bigger than others. You are much younger than Empress Maya was when she ascended to the throne, and she had already proved herself by managing a rebellion and then a war.
I know the history, Mr. Durant. And yes, I did try to see who was engaged and who was disinterested. I am tired, however, and I'd rather not spell it all out right now. Mr. Durant sighed and nodded.
Very well, Sarah. Maybe I'll go to court and gauge the mood for myself. I'm confident Lord Fitzroy is still on your side. I am also inclined to believe that Lord Wells can be swayed. Personally, I think he detests your father. The Ministry of Law, which favors the status quo, will of course side with your father. That leaves the Ministry of Thought. The Aldermaston of Mirwood has always spoken highly of you, but he's not the minister. You are a chaste, exemplary young woman. If three ministers support you, I don't see how you can lose. The rest of the Privy Council will take their cues from them.
But the Prime Minister is still powerful, Sarah said. Mr. Durant shrugged.
Prentice is. Everyone knows that Fitzroy would have been a better choice. It was your father's resentment that prevented it. Many still see that as a flaw in your father's judgment. I have high hopes for you. Well, why don't you get some rest? I will return this evening for dinner to tell you what I've learned.
Thank you, Mr. Durant, Sarah said with a sigh of relief. I would appreciate that. We will see you tonight. He bowed to her and offered a pleasant farewell to Sarah's mother before departing. Sarah chafed her hands, wanting to be alone. I'm going to my room, Mother.
Sarah,
said her mother worriedly. A sigh escaped Sarah's mouth. Yes?
I know you're tired. But please, there is some truth in what Lord Prentice said.
You have not taken the test yet. There are some mysteries you still do not understand. If you do become Empress, and I hope that you do, you will choose wise men and women to advise you. I would hope that you would permit me to serve on the Privy Council. I would be a devoted ally for you. You know you could depend on me. I hope you will consider it.
Sarah had thought about it, and, in truth, her mother was the last person she would consider for such a position of trust and responsibility. She never spoke of the people, only of herself and the injustices done to her.
I really must rest, Mother, Sarah said, her voice falling. Her mother's countenance fell when Sarah didn't immediately give her the reassurance she desired. There came into her eyes a look of accusation, a look of grievance, a look of bitterness. Without saying another word, Mother turned and left, the door striking shut harder than usual. Sarah's insides twisted with the conflict. Had she just made another enemy?
Shall we go to your room, Sarah?
Hugild asked softly, coaxingly. I should enjoy that, Sarah said. There were so many worries plaguing her that she hadn't taken time for her practice with the Leerings. The changes that had come so suddenly had nearly made her forget that she still had to pass the test, or the Privy Council might not even consider her. Arm in arm, she and Hugild walked up to her room together. From the window, she could see the soldiers milling on the street below. Lest one of them should look up and see her, she took a seat in the chair by the mirror, out of sight from below. Hugild started to unbraid her hair while she sat still, gazing at her reflection, seeing the little smudges on her face from the embellishments Hugild had applied that morning. Had she pretended to be someone she wasn't today? Would the people even want someone like her? Someone so unable to concentrate and remain focused? The black thoughts invaded her mind, gaining traction because they were at least partially true. She knew she lacked self-discipline. She knew her mind wandered too much. Hugild finished the unbraiding, then took a brush and started to work the kinks out. Gazing at her reflection, Sarah saw only the flaws. She knew she was pretty, but why was her nose shaped just so? Did her rounded cheeks make her look a little plump? Why couldn't she tame all these random, harmful thoughts? The first one seemed to have loosed a cascade that would drown her.
"You're so beautiful,"
Hugild said admiringly as she worked the brush through Sarah's hair.
"I always thought you were a pretty child, but you are radiant now."
"You're saying that because you used to be my governess," Sarah said, trying to dismiss the compliment. "Most people think I am only 14.
"No, Sarah, I said it because it's true. Your biggest problem isn't that you're small in stature.
I fear the prince from King Fountain is going to want you to be his bride, and you'll start a war by turning him down."
She smiled with affection and squeezed Sarah's shoulder. "Some men will use any pretext at all to fight," Sarah replied lightly, but she appreciated the compliment. It made her feel a little better.
"Something came for you today while you were gone,"
Hugild said cautiously. She reached into her dress pocket and withdrew two sealed letters.
"The first is from your friend at school. The second, well, I didn't open it, Sarah, even though I suspect who the author might be. You're 16 now and nearly a woman, but I still want what is best for you. Did Mr. Russell correspond with you while you were at Mirwood?"
Sarah's heart lurched when she saw the letters in the mirror. Being away from Seti for so long had caused an ache in her soul, like a festering bruise. Hearing news of her troubles had made her frantic for more information. But she also saw a little flush come to her cheeks at the mention of Will Russell.
"No.
Well, he did send me a letter recently, but it was the first I'd heard from him." Hugild handed both letters to her.
"I know I should tell your mother it came. She is the mistress of this house. But that will be your choice to make, not mine. You should be making your own choices now."
Sarah's hair fell well past her shoulders, and some of the ends teased the paper. She recognized Will's handwriting from the letter Commander Falking had delivered to her at Mirwood. You could tell a thing or two about a person by their style. Will was conscientious and confident. She slid her fingernail under the hard wax, breaking the seal, and opened the paper. Her hands were starting to tremble, but she forced them to be still as she anxiously read on.
"Dear Miss Fitzempress, I am uncertain whether or not you received my previous letter. My apologies for being bold in this request, but I have heard that there may have been an attempt on your life at the Abbey. It has vexed me to think that some blackguard tried to harm you. May the cholera take his life. I hope you are well and not terribly frightened. You were always so fearless when we were young. I've always admired you for that. If you have not received my previous letter, then I will use this opportunity to repeat the information previously conveyed. I will be coming to the city in a fortnight or less to receive orders for my first duty. Your father has done all in his power to hinder my career, and I fear that I may be banished to the far reaches of the Empire, or even a more miserable post on another world. He has recently renewed his efforts to force me to hand over the letters. Although they are innocent, as you well know, I fear he may use them against you. If I can possibly improve my fate and yours by surrendering the letters to you instead, then I am willing to part with them. I will bring them with me and offer to give them to you in person, save one, which I hope to keep as a memento of our childhood friendship. Not that I seek to boast with my crewmates, of course. Never would I desire to do anything that would cause you grief, Miss Fitzempress. My greatest regret is that I could not bid you goodbye when I was expelled from your father's house. I will meet you anywhere you choose if you can do me the honor of sending an invitation. Without one, it would prove impossible to get past the hosts that separate us. I will be stationed at the garrison at Whitehead in the city while I wait orders. If I do not hear back from you, I will not think any less of you. Perhaps my letters have been intercepted by others and will not reach you. But I must at least try to see you again. Your fellow conspirator of the hedge maze, William Russell."
It has been said that pain is a teacher. The lessons I have learned from clotting blood, black sutures, and near-constant pain have given me compassion for those who cannot escape the ghosts of hunger, disease, and fear. We must all of us confront our own ghosts and gain mastery over them. This is the essence of the test. Some students cannot face their demons, and by not facing them, they remain trapped in ignorance and fear of the unknown. It is always easier to face our shortcomings sooner rather than later. If we do not, interest comes due, and it is a terrible foe. I fear we have procured a lofty sum in our society today, a sum that will not be repaid without much loss of blood and treasure.
Thomas Abraham, Aldermaston of Mirwood Abbey. SETI. Chapter 17. Serpentine. Juliana Houghton had always defied tradition and convention with a mischievous smile. While Fitzroy didn't fall sway to the dictates of fashion, his sister-in-law snubbed them outright. Lady Marin's younger sister wore breeches like a man, high leather boots, and a leather corset, and had two daggers buckled to her belt, as well as a pistol strapped to her thigh. Her lips were always painted bright rouge, and while her curly hair was similar to her sister's, she'd been sailing the skies for so long that it was perpetually wind-blown and only half-tamed by a black ribbon. Juliana was full of energy and life, and had no intention of following normal womanly pursuits. She had earned her way up the ranks of the crew by being smarter, a harder worker, and more cunning than any of the sailors she worked alongside. Of course, she also had the advantage of being trained by Raj Saran, the bhikkhu, and had proven she didn't need to rely on the protection her relationship to a vice-admiral naturally bestowed. After her older brother disinherited the women in the family, Juliana went to live in a village beneath Gimmerton Sow with her sisters, until Fitzroy and Lady Marin married. She had then lived in Fog Willows until she was of age to study. As a youth, she spent each summer away from school at Fitzroy's mine in Dalcoeth, working hard to learn how to transport valuable commodities by skyship. When she finished her training, Fitzroy had offered her a job piloting one of his ships, but she'd refused to take what she had not yet earned. She instead joined the shipping trades overseen by the Ministry of Law. Her ship, her source of income and freedom, had earned its name, Serpentine, delivering serpentine stone from a minefield on another world. She'd earned her captainship by navigating the serpentine safely back to the Empire after the original captain was killed in a skirmish. Juliana had not gained her reputation or position by staying still. And after her arrival at Mirwood, SETI spent her afternoons not wandering the grounds wistfully, but learning how to knife fight, how to negotiate with dishonest men, and, most excitingly, how to pilot the serpentine. And she'd been encouraged not only to pilot it, but to test the ship to its limits.
"You're still too high, SETI!"
Juliana shouted above the roar of the wind as the tempest swept down a hillside within the marshland known as the Bearden Mere.
"Closer to the trees!"
The wind whipped Juliana's runaway hair, and the excited gleam in her eye showed how much she was enjoying the exercise. SETI gripped the spokes of the helm that connected her to the leerings on board. She'd tied her hair back in the same fashion favored by Juliana, so it wouldn't blow in her face. Some of the sailors were gripping the rails and casting nervous looks at one another.
"How close?"
SETI asked, feeling the power of the ship's leerings thrumming inside her. They were a league or so away from the abbey and coming up fast on Tor, the lopsided hill topped with a tower.
"You can see through the leerings on the hull. Frighten me."
A skyship, especially an unloaded Tempest, could do some amazing heart-pulsing stunts. And now she had permission, no orders, to indulge in them. Sinking deep into herself, SETI connected with the leerings on board. She sensed the threads of magic that wove through the serpentine's timbers. Sensed the nails and rivets, the caulking, the planks and seams,
She could see in almost every direction through the eyes of the Leerings on board. It was so easy to lose herself in the ship's magic. She made the Tempest lurch lower suddenly, causing grunts from the surprised crew. Gripping the helm spokes, she felt the power surge inside of her, raw and menacing as the vessel came so low it felt like they were sailing the treetops.
"That's it. That's better,"
Juliana crooned. Seti felt the ripples in her stomach as she guided the vessel up and down, matching her rhythm to the natural rise and fall of the landscape. The rush of energy inside her was dizzying. They raced over pools of stagnant water, which rippled in the wake of their passing, and birds scattered to get out of the way. The serpentine had yielded to her thoughts completely. In her mind, she controlled its functions, and it responded to her thoughts without hesitation. Ahead, she could see the Tor rising in the distance and felt the uneasy urge to send the ship upward at once, but she knew Juliana wouldn't allow it. A skyship would shatter against a mountainside. If she stopped the ship too quickly, the crew could be vaulted overboard. There were so many risks to manage, but the thrill of piloting the craft pulsed through her. A brazen smile rose to her face.
"Captain!"
one of the sailors shouted worriedly. They trusted their captain. Seti hadn't fully earned their respect yet. She noticed the Zephyr a moment after the sailor did. A huge oak tree in the midst of the woods blocked their current path, and a Zephyr had just lifted above it.
"It's a ministry ship,"
Seti said, feeling the thrum of magic coming from it.
"But we're bigger,"
Juliana said with a laugh.
"Don't veer. He'll get out of the way."
Having two ships in proximity to each other was especially dangerous. An error in judgment could wreck both. The Zephyr was coming straight at them, and Seti's heart pulsed with fear. She wanted to veer away. Why was the ministry ship acting so strangely?
"He will move," Juliana said. "Stay on course. He's testing you."
Seti bit her lip and increased the ship's speed. The vibrations within the Tempest shook her wrists and arms. Her legs felt weak from the stance she held. There was no time for her mind to wander, to worry about whether the Kishion had commandeered a ministry ship. She trusted Juliana's instincts, which had been honed over the years at the helm. Obey orders. The Zephyr peeled away and began racing toward the Tor.
"Don't let him beat you there,"
Juliana said with a snarl.
"Park us on top of the tower first."
A Zephyr was more maneuverable and faster, so it was an unreasonable order. But Seti was determined to follow it. Her heart was pounding in her chest as she tried to imagine how to perform the maneuver. She only had moments to decide on her strategy. The Zephyr zipped upward toward the hilltop. Seti could see the students climbing the steep stone steps to the summit. Some were pointing at the approaching skyships, watching the race unfold before their eyes. She increased the speed, and the thrumming started to rattle her teeth. The Tempest convulsed at the order. If they'd been heavily laden with a shipment of stone, the cargo would have burst loose of its confinement. Sailors hunkered down, gripping the rails, and she could sense their fear. Juliana wasn't afraid. Nothing made that woman afraid. Some instinct also told her that this was a deliberately staged race. Juliana had arranged it to test her skills. She had the speed she needed. The Zephyr continued its ascent up the Tor, aiming straight for the tower. It began to slow so that it wouldn't overshoot the mark. In order to get there first, Seti would need to uphold her current momentum, yet still slow the ship enough to land precisely at the top of the tower, without knocking it over, of course. In her mind, she imagined the maneuver from beginning to end. The answer came to her in a trice. The hull would need to pivot around so that the ship climbed the mountain rear first. Exposing the broadside of the Tempest to the wind would help slow it down naturally while it gained altitude. She could picture it in her mind, an almost corkscrew ascent, each round dropping speed and bringing the ship higher until they were level with the tower. It felt feasible. It wasn't overly dangerous, assuming the Zephyr didn't suddenly get in the way. The Leerings on board understood her intention, and they obeyed. The crew groaned as the tempest swung sideways. The motion of going forward and suddenly backward would have made less experienced passengers violently ill.